It was brand new, imported from the United States in wooden boxes, and it was very heavy. Along with his personal luggage, Ahmed Badib checked about $1.8 million in American cash on a Saudi Airlines commercial flight to Karachi, and as soon as he collected his bags in Pakistan, he regretted the absence of a trusted porter. He felt his muscles bulging under the strain. To reach Islamabad, Badib had to transfer to a domestic Pakistan International Airlines flight. Customs officials and security guards wanted to search his bags by hand. He was a lively man who was quick with an off-color joke, and he began to filibuster in front of the security tables. "These are very important documents. I cannot show them to anyone." "Fine," the guards said. "We'll put the boxes through the X-ray machine." Fearing the consequences of exposure, for himself and for the cash if it was discovered by poorly paid Pakistani customs officers, Badib began chattering again. "I have very important films in here. If you put them in the X-ray, they will burn." Finally, they let him pass. He heaved his boxes across the check-in counter. Landing in Islamabad, he was relieved to see that his mission had attracted a high-ranking reception party. General Akhtar Abdul Rahman, the ISI chief, welcomed Badib as he came off the plane. In his mid-30s, when the anti-Soviet jihad gathered force in the early 1980s, Ahmed Badib was a desert-born Saudi Arabian who had attended an American college in the snow-swept plains of North Dakota. He had worked for a time as a teacher employed by the Saudi Ministry of Education. One of his pupils had been an earnest young man named Osama bin Laden. They had become friends. Ahmed Badib was a stout, bearded man with dark skin and a natural, boisterous confidence. By dint of luck, family connections, and the generous machinery of Saudi government patronage, he had lately graduated from academia to become chief of staff to the director of the General Intelligence Department of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Soon after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the chief of Saudi intelligence, dispatched Badib to Pakistan with the kingdom's calling card, cash dollars. The Saudi intelligence service, along with Saudi charities whose funds the spy agency sometimes directed, was becoming ISI's most generous patron, even more so than the CIA. Akhtar led Ahmed Badib to a meeting with President Zia in Rawalpindi. Badib announced that Saudi Arabia had decided to supply cash to ISI so that the Pakistani intelligence service could buy precision-made rocket-propelled grenade launchers from China, among other weapons. Badib's cash would be the first of many installments. As Zia and Badib talked that night, five ISI generals pried open Badib's boxes in an adjoining room and began to count the money, as Badib recalled it. He tried to keep half an eye on them while maintaining polite conversation with the Pakistani president. "Excuse me, Mr. President, I have to see if the generals are..." "It's counted," he told them in the other room, half-joking. "It's brand new. The serial numbers are there." A Saudi spy quickly became accustomed to being treated like a bank teller. "We don't do operations," Prince Turki once told a CIA colleague from the DO's Near East Division. "We don't know how. All we know how to do is write checks." As it did in Langley, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan had a galvanizing impact on the headquarters of the Saudi General Intelligence Department, or GID, the Desert Kingdom's main external spy service. Saudi Arabia's deeply religious Bedouin royal family viewed Soviet communism as heresy. A Soviet drive toward the Persian Gulf threatened the Saudi elite's oil wealth. Leading Saudi princes embraced the American view of Pakistan as a frontline state in the worldwide effort to contain Soviet ambitions. And beyond statecraft, Turki and Akhtar both believed fervently in the importance of an Islamic brotherhood which ignored territorial frontiers, as one of Akhtar's senior aides put it. After the upheavals of 1979, Crown Prince Fahd, soon to become king, saw Pakistan as Saudi Arabia's most muscular, reliable ally on its eastern flank. He authorized his intelligence service to open its bountiful treasury to Akhtar's ISI. The clandestine alliance between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan was grounded in history. Each was a young, insecure nation that saw Islam as central to its identity. Pakistani troops had been hired by the Saudis in the past for security deployments in the kingdom. The Saudi Air Force had secretly provided air cover over Karachi during Pakistan's 1971 war with India. Until the early 1980s, the Saudi spy service played a limited role. The General Intelligence Department had been for many years a weak and unprofessional organization. It had been built around royal family connections. Modern Saudi Arabia's founding monarch, King Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, who had 41 children by 17 wives and reigned from 1902 until his death in 1953, at one stage dispatched one of his older sons, Faisal, to Turkey to evaluate a marriageable woman with royal lineage. Faisal ended up marrying the woman himself. His new wife's wealthy Turkish half-brother, Kemal Adam, who had connections across the Arab world, was appointed during the 1960s as Saudi Arabia's founding spy chief. Adam opened GID offices and embassies abroad. He was fired during the mid-1970s and replaced by his worldly young nephew, Prince Turki Al-Faisal. It was an appointment typical of Saudi politics, where maintaining balance among restive royal family clans was imperative. From this semi-accidental beginning, Prince Turki went on to hold the GID directorship for more than two decades, becoming one of the longest-serving and most influential intelligence operatives on the world stage. As much as any individual, Prince Turki became an architect of Afghanistan's destiny and of American engagements with Islamic radicalism in the two decades after 1979. He picked winners and losers among Afghan commanders. He funded Islamist revolutionaries across the Middle East. He created alliances among these movements, and he paid large subsidies to the Pakistan Intelligence Service, aiding its rise as a kind of shadow government. A champion of Saudi Arabia's austere Islam, a promoter of women's rights, a multimillionaire, a workaholic, a pious man, a sipper of banana daiquiris, an intriguer, an intellectual, a loyal prince, a sincere friend of Americans, a generous funder of anti-American causes, Prince Turki embodied Saudi Arabia's cascading contradictions. His spy agency became an important liaison as the CIA confronted communism and later militant Islam. At least as much as Pakistan's ISI, the Saudi intelligence agency that Prince Turki built became the chalice, sometimes poisoned, sometimes sweet, from which the CIA's Near East and counter-terrorist officers believed they had no choice but to drink. Prince Turki Al-Faisal was born in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia on February 15, 1945, the day after Saudi King Abdulaziz boarded an American warship anchored in the Red Sea to meet for the first time the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, who was returning from Yalta. The Bedouin king brought aboard his own herd of sheep so that he could slaughter them at mealtimes. He watched newsreels of American soldiers in action and befuddled his hosts by then sleeping for long and unpredictable hours. Yet Roosevelt, who even before the Nazi surrender sought allies for the post-war world, made a favorable impression on him. They discussed Palestine and oil. Abdulaziz knew relatively little of the world, but he identified with the Arab struggle against the Zionists. Roosevelt's agents on the Arabian Peninsula, some of them oil prospectors, had begun to glimpse the vast wealth sloshing beneath the sands. They had urged their president to embrace the Saudi royals before the British wheedled in, and Roosevelt did, flattering Abdulaziz as best he could and winning limited pledges of military and economic cooperation. The Al-Sauds, the royal family Abdulaziz led, had largely evaded colonial subjugation. They lived in an area so bleak and isolated that it did not interest European powers. They first burst out of the hot, empty deserts of the central Nejd region in the 18th century to wage tribal war. The Arabian Peninsula then was a severe, poor, sparsely inhabited wasteland of camel-breeding nomads. The nearest thing to civilization was Jeddah, a desultory trading port of the Ottoman Empire, that had become a modest prize in colonial competitions. Few of its urbane residents dared to venture far from the Red Sea. The interior lands were scorching, and the local tribes were unforgiving. Muslim pilgrims did flock inland each year to Mecca and Medina, but they had to beware of robbery and extortion on the roads. The Al-Sauds were but one militia among many until they forged a fateful alliance with an austere and martial desert preacher, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. The decorous, arty, tobacco-smoking, hashish-imbibing, music-happy, drum-pounding Egyptian and Ottoman nobility who traveled across Arabia to pray at Mecca each year angered Wahhab deeply. In his personal reading of the Quran, the Ottoman pilgrims were not the Muslims they claimed to be, but were blasphemous polytheists, worshippers of false idols. Local Arabs also aggravated Wahhab by honoring saints with monuments or decorated gravestones, and by mixing Islam with animist superstitions. All this Wahhab denounced as bid'ah, forbidden by God. People who worshipped graven images lived outside Allah's true community. They were Allah's enemies, and they should be converted or destroyed. Wahhab won the allegiance of the Al-Saud tribes to his theology, or they won him to their political cause, depending on which family recounts the history. Either way, Wahhab's proselytizing merged with the Al-Saud's military ambition. When the United Religious Militia overran an oasis, they destroyed grave markers and holy trees and spread the unforgiving word of Allah as interpreted by Wahhab. At one point, Wahhab came across a woman accused of fornication and ordered her stoned to death. The preacher's fearsome legend spread. Honored with great tracts of land for his righteousness, Wahhab ultimately retreated to a life of religious contemplation and multiple marriages. After his death, the Egyptians surged onto the peninsula and pushed his descendants and the Al-Saud tribes back into the empty Najd. The vengeance-minded Egyptians executed one of Wahhab's grandsons after forcing him to listen to music from a one-stringed violin. There the Saudis languished for most of the 19th century, herding animals and nursing grievances. They roared back to the Red Sea when the Ottoman Empire collapsed amid the chaos of World War I. The Al-Sauds were led this time by their extraordinary commander, Abdulaziz, a laconic and skillful emir who united the peninsula's fractious Bedouin tribes through military courage and political acumen. His deliberate movements, his slow, sweet smile, and the contemplative glance of his heavy-lidded eyes, though they add to his dignity and charm, do not accord with the Western conception of a vigorous personality, wrote a British traveler who encountered the king. Nevertheless, report credits him with powers of physical endurance rare even in hard-bitten Arabia. Abdulaziz embraced Wahhabi doctrine. He sponsored a new, fierce, semi-independent vanguard of Ikhwan, or brothers, war-fighting believers who dressed in distinctive white turbans and trimmed their beards and mustaches to express Islamic solidarity. The Ikhwan conquered village after village, town after town. In Wahhab's name, they enforced bans on alcohol, tobacco, embroidered silk, gambling, fortune-telling, and magic. They denounced telephones, radios, and automobiles as affronts to God's law. When a motor truck first appeared in their territory, they set it on fire and sent its driver fleeing on foot. Abdulaziz skillfully employed the Ikhwan to capture Mecca, Medina, and Jeddah between 1914 and 1926. But the king soon felt threatened by the Brotherhood's unquenchable radicalism. The Ikhwan revolted, and Abdulaziz put them down with modern machine guns. To outflank the Brotherhood's popular appeal to Islamic righteousness, Abdulaziz founded the Saudi Religious Police, organized eventually as the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. The king declared that his royal family would govern strictly by the doctrines of Wahhab, enforcing a severe and patriarchal piety shorn of adornment. It was the debut of a strategy employed by the Saudi royal family throughout the 20th century. Threatened by Islamic radicalism, they embraced it, hoping to retain control. The Al-Saud's claims to power on the Arabian Peninsula were weak and grew largely from conquests made by allied jihadists. They now ruled the holiest shrines in worldwide Islam. There seemed to them no plausible politics but strict, official religiosity. Many among the royal family were themselves true believers. Theirs was, after all, the only modern nation-state created by jihad. Prince Turki al-Faisal, the future spy chief, grew up less than a generation after the Saudi nation's awkward, blood-soaked birth. He came of age before the kingdom's great boom in oil revenues, before its accompanying modernization drives, before the hastily laid ribbons of California-style freeways and the indoor shopping malls. In the mid-1950s, when Turki was a boy, two-thirds of Saudi Arabians were still nomads or semi-nomads. Less than a quarter lived in cities or towns. Even in the mid-1960s, half of Saudi Arabians earned their living from animal husbandry. Slavery was banned only in 1962. Africans and Asians continued to be indentured informally in Saudi households for years afterward. Traditional Bedouin nomad culture viewed settled labor with contempt. Americans and other foreigners were beginning to drill for oil in the eastern provinces, and the first investments in roads and telephone lines had begun, but the kingdom of Turki's childhood was still largely an impoverished land of wanderers, tent dwellers, camel breeders, and preaching mullahs, all ruled by a shaky alliance between a privileged royal family and its righteous ulama, or senior Islamic clergy. In this unmodern landscape, Prince Turki's father, Prince Faisal, was a relatively modern man. He was a hard-working nationalist, well-read, and a leading technocrat and government reformer among Abdulaziz's older sons, some of whom had little education and sybaritic appetites. Prince Faisal believed in balanced budgets, social investments, and the benefits of technology. He also embraced Wahhabi Islam, and argued that the kingdom should pursue social change slowly and carefully. An experienced provincial governor, he seemed destined for the Saudi throne and expected his sons to prepare for serious lives. This meant an American education. Faisal dispatched Prince Turki at age 14 to Lawrenceville School, a preparatory and boarding school for wealthy boys in New Jersey. To call the young Turki's transition to prep school a culture shock would hardly do it justice. "I was alone," Turki recalled years later. "I was extremely nervous. As I entered the dormitory, I felt somebody's hand slapping me on my backside." A young man called out to him. "Hi, my name is Steve Callahan. Who are you?" Turki stood in stunned silence. "Because in Saudi Arabia, you never hit anybody on the backside." Finally, he offered his name. Callahan replied, "Oh, like a Thanksgiving turkey?" In later years, Turki rarely spoke in public, and more rarely still did he speak of his inner life, so it is difficult to know what impressions he had of America, traumatic or favorable or both, from Lawrenceville. Barely an adolescent, Turki had been sent oceans away from home, catapulted from an isolated kingdom of austere Islamic ritual to an American world of football, sex, and beer. At least his fellow Lawrenceville students had wealth, as he did. There were some other foreign students as well. Turki's prep school classmates included a future president of Honduras. Back in the kingdom, his father entered a tenacious struggle with his older half-brother, Saud, the first of Abdulaziz's sons, to succeed to the throne after the great patriarch's death. By taking many wives and siring many sons, Abdulaziz created multiple competing branches within the royal family. Confused power struggles erupted as soon as he was gone. Saud's spendthrift ways exacerbated the trouble. The oil bubbled and the dollars began to flow, but Saud and his retainers managed to spend it all and then some on palaces, shopping sprees, and poorly managed development projects. In search of order, the family arranged for Prince Faisal's appointment as crown prince. But Saud resented him, and in frustration Faisal resigned his office while Turki was still at Lawrenceville. Prepped in the American East Coast manner, Turki matriculated at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. in 1964, a member of the same class as an ambitious, talkative boy from Hope, Arkansas named Bill Clinton. In a rare breakdown of Clinton's networking radar, he failed to seek out and befriend a rich crown prince's son destined for power. The pair met for the first time at the White House soon after Clinton became president. Years later, Turki told a reunion at Georgetown, referring to Clinton's infamous claim that he had tried marijuana but never inhaled. "It wasn't just the class that didn't inhale. It was the class that tried to smoke banana peels. Do you remember that? I promise you, can anybody imagine smoking a banana peel? But those were the days." On campus, someone approached Turki during his freshman year and asked, "Did you hear the news?" Turki said he had not. Oh, your father has become king. Saud had finally relinquished his crown. Georgetown's dean called Turki in and asked if he wanted a security detail. Turki declined because, as he later put it wryly, I'd never have anybody following me in those days, especially at Georgetown. He left the university after his junior year. He said later it was because he was upset and disillusioned by the Arab defeat by Israel in the Six-Day War of 1967. You can't imagine the state of total depression and sense of failure that struck the Arab world. A few years later, he finished his education in England. Turki found employment as a counselor in a government ministry before following his uncle as director of the GID. By then, Turki's father lay dead of an assassin's bullet. 2 years after he shocked America by leading the anti-Israel oil boycott that sent global energy prices soaring, King Faisal was murdered by an aggrieved, deranged cousin. His killing had roots in the kingdom's struggles over modernization. In 1965, Saudi television debuted, and Wahhabi radicals stormed a government studio in violent protest. One of the protesters, a cousin of King Faisal, died in the shootout. A decade later, on March 25, 1975, the victim's brother leveled a pistol at the king during a local festival and shot him to death in apparent revenge. Turki had lost his father to a terrorist act, at least partially derived from Saudi Arabia's attempt to marry post-industrial development with regressive Islamic orthodoxy. It was, Turki said later, without elaborating, the most painful thing. As Prince Turki took charge in the late 1970s, the Saudi intelligence service was in the throes of a massive expansion. Gushing oil revenue poured into every bureaucratic nook and cranny in the kingdom. Saudi Arabia's 5-year government budget from 1969 to 1974 was $9.2 billion. During the next 5 years, it was $142 billion. Just a generation removed from nomadic poverty, the kingdom was on a forced march to the computer age. Turki wired up the General Intelligence Department offices inside the kingdom and in 32 embassies and consulates abroad. All the software, however, failed to detect the violent plot by the crazed Juhayman al-Utaibi to seize Mecca in November 1979. With its echoes of the Ikhwan revolt put down by Abdulaziz, the Mecca uprising rattled all of the Saudi security agencies. It also helped convince the royal family that it needed to invest heavily in spies and police. Not only the Saudis worried. After the Shah of Iran's fall, the American intelligence community feared the Saudi royal family might be next. The CIA station in Jeddah tried to improve its reporting on the kingdom's opaque internal politics. The Mecca uprising only emphasized how little the agency knew about Islamic radicalism on the peninsula. One way to deepen access was to cozy up to the Saudi spy service by providing technical assistance. After 1979, the CIA's station in Saudi Arabia redoubled its efforts to recruit sources in the kingdom unilaterally. At the same time, as part of its official liaison, the CIA helped GID with its computer system and also with a sensitive program to capture electronic intercepts from Soviet sources. Turki and his aides traveled to Langley, as well as European and Arab capitals, to study how other intelligence agencies were organized. As he built GID, he copied the CIA's blueprint. Prince Turki was the agency's non-cabinet-level director. Immediately beneath him were half a dozen directorates. As at Langley, one of these was the Directorate of Operations, which carried out covert action and liaisons with foreign intelligence agencies. Turki also organized the Directorate of Intelligence, which produced classified reports for the Saudi royal family about security issues. His Directorate of Intelligence even circulated a daily intelligence digest for the Saudi king and crown prince, mirroring the president's daily brief circulated at the White House by the CIA. His impeccable English, his polite manner, his sly humor, his elegant taste for luxury, his serious reading of history, and above all, his rare ability to navigate between Saudi Arabia and the West, and to interpret each for the other, helped ingratiate Prince Turki with the Americans. He was an unassuming man who spoke softly, but with a sweeping, cogent confidence. One Arabic-speaking CIA officer who worked with him described Turki as the most accomplished, nuanced interpreter of the English language into Arabic that he had ever met. Turki consumed Western news sources voraciously. He became a regular delegate to the annual gatherings of the international elite in Davos, Switzerland, and other off-the-record conferences devoted to finance, strategy, and the global balance of power. At the same time, some at the CIA recognized that Turki was a master manipulator. "He was deceitful," recalled Claire George, a senior officer in the CIA's clandestine service who eventually ran the agency's Directorate of Operations. The scale of wealth Turki seemed to acquire on the job stunned his American counterparts. As George put it, "You're not going to find somebody to run their intelligence service who hasn't stolen a lot of money." Of course, in the Saudi system, there were no clear lines between government funds, royal wealth, and private wealth. All the senior princes in the kingdom enriched themselves. Turki used the GID's funds not only to live well, but to recruit American and European friends willing to defend Saudi interests. When CIA station chiefs, State Department diplomats, or MI6 officers with experience in Saudi Arabia retired or left government service, many landed on the GID payroll as Turki's well-paid private consultants, his eyes and ears in Washington, London, and elsewhere. Turki also systematically subsidized intelligence services in poorer Arab countries, buying information and allies. Ahmed Badib and his brother Saeed were two of Turki's key aides. Their father had been a modestly successful merchant in Jeddah. Ahmed Badib was an energetic operator working as Turki's advance man, bagman, and operational surrogate. Saeed was milder, bespectacled, and bookish. He earned a Ph.D. at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. during the early 1980s, and then returned to his post as chief of the GID's Directorate of Intelligence. He wrote his doctoral thesis on Saudi relations with Yemen and Egypt, and published a book about Saudi relations with Iran. Both Badib brothers interacted regularly with CIA counterparts. The Saudi royals, so hostile to Marxist atheism that they did not even maintain diplomatic relations with the Soviets, had quietly collaborated with the CIA against Moscow for decades. During the annual Hajj season, the pilgrimage to Mecca made in the 12th month of the Muslim year, the Saudis arranged for CIA officers to interview Muslim pilgrims from Soviet Central Asia about conditions back home. During the 1970s, when CIA covert operations were inhibited by scandals in Congress and caution at the White House, Turki's GID joined Britain, France, Morocco, and Iran to form a safari club that worked covertly against Soviet-backed Marxist movements in Africa. When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Turki quickly reached out to Pakistan. The ISI's Akhtar flew to the kingdom within weeks and met with Turki and Ahmed Badib in a restaurant in Riyadh. Akhtar carried a message from President Zia warning that Saudi Arabia itself faced danger if the Soviet incursion wasn't checked. Soon, Badib began his shuttle to Islamabad and Peshawar, sometimes hauling his wooden boxes of cash. Turki believed that the Soviet invasion signaled a drive by Moscow to establish a strategic parity with the United States in the Middle East. Until recently, arms sales had been the communists' primary calling card in the Arab world. Now the Soviet Union was looking to gain more influence over oil prices and supplies. Occupying Afghanistan was not per se a Soviet objective, he concluded, but a step toward increasing its power in the region through proxy communist parties and leftist movements. Geographically, Turki thought, Pakistan offered the best path to confront Soviet ambitions. Aid to the Afghan rebels, channeled through Pakistan's army and intelligence service, would also helpfully strengthen Pakistan as a regional ally after the devastation of its war with India in 1971. Turki reached a formal agreement with the CIA in July 1980 to match U.S. congressional funding for the Afghan rebels. Each year, the Saudis sent their part of the money to their embassy in Washington. The Saudi ambassador in Washington, Bandar bin Sultan, then transferred the funds to a Swiss bank account controlled by the CIA. The agency used its Swiss account to make its covert purchases on the international arms markets. Langley's Near East Division, which handled the Saudi liaison, had to continually haggle with Turki's GID over late payments. Once the money was pried out of Riyadh's treasury and transferred to Washington, Bandar would often hold on to the funds for weeks. Near East Division officers speculated that Bandar used the delays to enrich his embassy or himself with the float. The millions of dollars in interest that piled up daily from the Saudis' enormous Mujahideen-bound bank deposits. Turki took a personal interest in the Afghan program, traveling to Pakistan up to 5 times a month. Turki did not object to entering into Afghanistan, Ahmed Badib recalled. The Saudi prince made a favorable impression on Pakistan's ISI brigadiers, his main partners on the Afghan frontier. Although his character was formed by his aristocratic upbringing, he was the most humble and modest Arab prince I ever met, recalled Mohammed Youssef, who directed ISI operations for 4 years during the mid-1980s. His education and experience in the West made him completely free of the common Arab prejudices toward non-Arabs. Abdurrab Rasul Sayaf became the Saudis' most important client among the Mujahideen rebels. A hulking former professor of Islamic law at Kabul University, who maintained a long white-flecked beard, Sayaf had lived for years in Cairo, where he acquired florid and impeccable Arabic. Crackdowns by the Afghan secret police, including a lengthy prison sentence, forced him into exile in Pakistan. As Prince Turki's GID began to penetrate the Afghan jihad in 1980, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, an alliance of Muslim governments, held a major summit in Saudi Arabia, in the resort town of Taif. The Saudis wanted the conference to condemn Soviet interference in Afghanistan. Yasser Arafat, then backing many leftist causes, planned to speak in Moscow's defense. Afghan rebel leaders flew in from Peshawar to appeal for their cause. Ahmed Badib was assigned to select just one of the Mujahideen leaders to make a speech right after Arafat, attacking the Soviet invasion as an affront to Islam. Several Afghan rebel leaders spoke passable Arabic, but Badib found that Sayaf, then an assistant to another leader, was by far the most fluent and effective. "We chose him to give the speech," Badib recalled later. Immediately, however, the Afghan leaders began to fight among themselves. Unbelievable, guys! Everyone was claiming that he represents the Afghans and he should give the speech. The scene became so unruly that Badib decided to lock all of them in a Taif prison until they agreed on a single speaker. After 6 hours of jailhouse debate, the Afghans accepted Sayaf. Badib then decided that his client needed a better stage name. As he recalled it, Sayaf had been introduced to him as Abdul Rasul Sayaf. The first two names, he said, translated to Saudis as Slave of the Prophet, suggesting that Sayaf's ancestors had been indentured servants. By adding Abdur to the name, Badib altered its meaning to Slave of the God of the Prophet, suggesting religious devotion, not low social status. For years, Badib was proud that Saudi intelligence had literally given Sayaf his name. An emboldened Sayaf returned to Peshawar and formed his own Afghan rebel party, drawing on Saudi cash. Sayaf promoted Wahhabi doctrine among the rebels and provided GID with access to the war independent of ISI control. Sayaf also offered GID a means to compete for Afghan influence against Saudi Arabia's wealthy Wahhabi clerics. Sheikh Abdul bin Baz, the head of the kingdom's official religious establishment and a descendant of the Wahhabi sect's founder, had his own Mujahideen clients. Bin Baz managed charities that sent millions of dollars and hundreds of volunteer Arab fighters to help an austere Afghan religious leader, Jamil al-Rahman, who had set up a small Wahhabi-inspired emirate in an isolated valley of Afghanistan's Kunar province. Badib saw Sayaf as the GID-backed alternative to this and other rival Wahhabi groups. The Saudi spy service's murky mix of alliance and rivalry with the kingdom's Islamic ulama, scholars of Islamic law, became a defining feature of the Afghan jihad as it swelled during the 1980s. Middle-class, pious Saudis flush with oil wealth embraced the Afghan cause, as American churchgoers might respond to an African famine or a Turkish earthquake. Charity is a compulsion of Islamic law. The money flowing from the kingdom arrived at the Afghan frontier in all shapes and sizes. gold jewelry dropped on offering plates by merchants' wives in Jeddah mosques, bags of cash delivered by businessmen to Riyadh charities as zakat, an annual Islamic tithe, fat checks written from semi-official government accounts by minor Saudi princes, bountiful proceeds raised in annual telethons led by Prince Salman, the governor of Riyadh, and richest of all, the annual transfers from GID to the CIA's Swiss bank accounts. Prince Turki said years later that GID often controlled who among the Afghans was authorized to receive the semi-official and unofficial charity funds, but it was never clear how effectively the spy service oversaw the ulama-run charities. There was relatively little supervision during the early and mid-1980s, a lack of control that Badib later regretted. Even more ambiguous than the money trail was the legion of Saudis flocking to join or support the Afghan jihad. It was rarely clear who was acting as a formal agent of the kingdom's intelligence service and who was acting as an independent religious volunteer. To the Pakistani generals and American intelligence officers who came to know of him, no Saudi more embodied that mystery than Ahmed Badib's former pupil from Jeddah, Osama bin Laden. Mohammed bin Laden migrated to Jeddah in 1931 from a harsh, impoverished valley in Yemen. He arrived just a few years after Abdul Aziz and his fierce Ikhwan took control of the Red Sea coastline. Talented, ambitious, frugal, and determined, bin Laden cobbled together a construction business one project at a time during the sparse years of the 1930s and 1940s. He built houses, roads, offices, and hotels, and he began to cultivate the Saudi royal clan. In the tradition of Saudi and Yemeni sheikhs, bin Laden took multiple young wives. He ultimately fathered about 50 children. By the time his 17th son, Osama, was born in 1957 to a young Syrian wife, Mohammed bin Laden had established himself in Jeddah, Medina, where Osama lived as a boy, and Riyadh. First under King Saud, and then especially under Crown Prince and King Faisal, bin Laden's construction firm became the kingdom's lead contractor for such ambitious and politically sensitive projects as a new highway from Jeddah to Taif, and the massive refurbishment of the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. Prince Turki's father and Osama bin Laden's father were friends, business partners, and political allies. Mohammed bin Laden was a worthy man, as Prince Turki recalled. He was truly a genuine hero in the eyes of many Saudis, including the royal family, because of what he did for the kingdom. But he was always the construction man. When there was a job to be done, bin Laden would do it. King Faisal appointed Mohammed bin Laden as his minister of public works. The king's patronage crowned the bin Laden family with open royal support and ensured that their construction fortune would grow into the billions of dollars as the Saudi treasury reaped the oil profits stoked by Faisal's OPEC gambits. As a child, Osama rode his father's bulldozers and wandered his teeming construction sites in the boom towns of the Hijaz, as the region around the Red Sea is known. But he hardly knew his father. In 1967, just 3 years into Faisal's reign, Mohammed bin Laden died in a plane crash. Faisal intervened to establish a trust to oversee the operations of the bin Laden construction firm. He wanted to guarantee its stability until the older bin Laden sons, led by Osama's half-brother Salem, could grow up and take charge. In effect, because of the initiative of Prince Turki's father, the bin Laden boys became, for a time, wards of the Saudi kingdom. Salem and other bin Ladens paid their way into elite British boarding schools and American universities. On the wings of their wealth, many of them moved comfortably and even adventurously between the kingdom and the West. Salem married an English aristocrat, played the guitar, piloted airplanes, and vacationed in Orlando. A photograph of the bin Laden children snapped on a cobbled Swedish street during the early 1970s shows a shaggy, mod clan in bell-bottoms. Perhaps because his mother was not one of Mohammed's favored wives, or because of choices she made about schooling, or because of her boy's own preferences, Osama never slipped into the jet stream that carried his half-brothers and half-sisters to Geneva and London and Aspen. Instead, he enrolled at Jeddah's King Abdulaziz University, a prestigious school by Saudi standards, but one isolated from world affairs and populated by Islamist professors from Egypt and Jordan, some of them members of the Muslim Brotherhood or connected to its underground proselytizing networks. Osama bin Laden was an impressionable college sophomore on a $1 million annual allowance during the first shocking upheavals of 1979. His teachers in Jeddah included Abdullah Azam, a Palestinian who had become a spiritual founder of Hamas, the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist rival to the secular leftist Palestine Liberation Organization. Another of bin Laden's teachers was Mohammed Qutb, the brother of Sayyid Qutb, an Egyptian Islamic radical executed in 1966 for advocating his secular government's violent overthrow. In these classrooms, bin Laden studied the imperatives and nuances of contemporary Islamic jihad. Exactly when bin Laden made his first visit to Pakistan to meet leaders of the Afghan Mujahideen isn't clear. In later interviews, bin Laden suggested that he flew to Pakistan within weeks of the Soviet invasion. Others place his first trip later, shortly after he graduated from King Abdulaziz University, with a degree in economics and public administration in 1981. Bin Laden had met Afghan Mujahideen leaders at Mecca during the annual Hajj. The Afghan guerrillas with Saudi connections quickly learned they could raise enormous sums outside of ISI's control by rattling their tin cups before wealthy pilgrims. According to Badib, on bin Laden's first trip to Pakistan, he brought donations to the Lahore offices of Jamaat-e-Islami, Zia's political shock force. Jamaat was the Pakistani offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. Its students had sacked the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad in 1979. Bin Laden did not trust the official Pakistan intelligence service, Badib recalled, and preferred to funnel his initial charity through private religious and political networks. From the beginning of the Afghan jihad, Saudi intelligence used religious charities to support its own unilateral operations. This mainly involved funneling money and equipment to favored Afghan commanders outside ISI or CIA control. Badib established safe houses for himself and other Saudi spies through Saudi charities operating in Peshawar. Badib also stayed frequently at the Saudi embassy in Islamabad. "The humanitarian aid, that was completely separate from the Americans," Badib recalled. "And we insisted that the Americans will not get to that, get involved, especially in the beginning," in part because some of the Islamist Mujahideen objected to direct contacts with Western infidels. With Zia's encouragement, Saudi charities built along the Afghan frontier hundreds of madrasas, or Islamic schools, where they taught young Afghan refugees to memorize the Quran. Ahmed Badib made personal contributions to establish his own refugee school along the frontier. He did insist that his school's curriculum emphasize crafts and practical trade skills, not Quran memorization. "I thought, why does everybody have to be a religious student?" In Spy Lexicon, each of the major intelligence agencies working the Afghan jihad, GID, ISI, and the CIA, began to compartment their work, even as all three collaborated with one another through formal liaisons. Working together, they purchased and shipped to the Afghan rebels tens of thousands of tons of weapons and ammunition. Separately, they spied on one another and pursued independent political agendas. Howard Hart, the CIA station chief in Islamabad until 1984, regarded it as the worst-kept secret in town that the Saudis were privately running guns and cash to Sayaf. The Saudis insisted that there be no interaction in Pakistan between the CIA and the GID. All such contact was to take place in Riyadh or Langley. GID tried to keep secret the subsidies it paid to the ISI outside of the arms-buying program. For their part, CIA officers tried to shield their own direct contacts with Afghan commanders, such as Abdul Haq. Bin Laden moved within Saudi intelligence's compartmented operations, outside of CIA eyesight. CIA archives contain no record of any direct contact between a CIA officer and bin Laden during the 1980s. CIA officers delivering sworn testimony before Congress in 2002 asserted there were no such contacts, and so did multiple CIA officers and U.S. officials in interviews. The CIA became aware of bin Laden's work with Afghan rebels in Pakistan and Afghanistan later in the 1980s, but did not meet with him even then, according to these record searches and interviews. If the CIA did have contact with bin Laden during the 1980s and subsequently covered it up, it has so far done an excellent job. Prince Turki and other Saudi intelligence officials said years later that bin Laden was never a professional Saudi intelligence agent. Still, while the exact character and timeline of his dealings with GID remains uncertain, it seems clear that bin Laden did have a substantial relationship with Saudi intelligence. Some CIA officers later concluded that bin Laden operated as a semi-official liaison between GID, the international Islamic religious networks such as Jamaat, and the leading Saudi-backed Afghan commanders such as Sayaf. Ahmed Badib describes an active operational partnership between GID and Osama bin Laden, a relationship more direct than Prince Turki or any other Saudi official has yet acknowledged. By Badib's account, bin Laden was responsive to specific direction from both the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence agencies during the early and mid-1980s. Bin Laden may not have been paid a regular stipend or salary, he was a wealthy man, but Badib's account suggests that bin Laden may have arranged formal road building and other construction deals with GID during this period, contracts from which bin Laden would have earned profits. Badib's account is incomplete and in places ambiguous. He is known to have given only two interviews on the subject, and he does not address every aspect of his history with bin Laden in depth. But his description of the relationship, on its face, is one of intimacy and professional alliance. "I loved Osama, and considered him a good citizen of Saudi Arabia," Badib said. The Badib family and the bin Ladens hailed from the same regions of Saudi Arabia and Yemen, Badib said. When Ahmed Badib first met Osama at school in Jeddah, before Badib became Turki's chief of staff, bin Laden had joined the religious committee at the school as opposed to any of the many other committees, Badib recalled. "He was not an extremist at all, and I liked him because he was a decent and polite person. In school and academically, he was in the middle." As the Afghan jihad roused Saudis to action, bin Laden met regularly in the kingdom with senior princes, including Prince Turki and Prince Naif, the Saudi Minister of the Interior, who liked and appreciated him, as Badib recalled it. And as he shuttled back and forth to Afghanistan, bin Laden developed strong relations with the Saudi intelligence and with our embassy in Pakistan. The Saudi embassy in Islamabad had a very powerful and active role in the Afghan jihad. The ambassador often hosted dinner parties for visiting Saudi sheikhs or government officials and would invite bin Laden to attend. He had a very good rapport with the ambassador and with all the Saudi ambassadors that served there. Prince Turki has acknowledged meeting bin Laden several times at these embassy receptions in Islamabad. "He seemed to be a relatively pleasant man," Turki recalled, "very shy, soft-spoken, and as a matter of fact, he didn't speak much at all." But Turki has suggested these meetings were passing encounters of little consequence. He has also said they were his only dealings with bin Laden during the early and mid-1980s. Badib has said that he met with bin Laden only in my capacity as his former teacher. Given that Badib was working full-time as the chief of staff to the director of Saudi intelligence, this description strains credulity. Badib described a relationship that was far more active than just a series of casual chats at diplomatic receptions. The Saudi embassy in Islamabad would ask bin Laden for some things, and he would respond positively, Badib recalled. Also, the Pakistanis saw in him one who was helping them do what they wanted done there. As Badib organized safe houses through Saudi religious charities, bin Laden's role in Afghanistan, and he was about 24-25 years old at the time, was to build roads in the country to make easy the delivery of weapons to the Mujahideen. The Afghans regarded bin Laden as a nice and generous person who has money and good contacts with Saudi government officials. The chief of staff to the director of Saudi intelligence put it simply, "We were happy with him. He was our man. He was doing all what we asked him. For now." 5. Don't make it our war. In January 1984, CIA Director William Casey briefed President Reagan and his National Security Cabinet about the progress of their covert Afghan war. It had been 4 years since the first Lee Enfield rifles arrived in Karachi. Mujahideen warriors had killed or wounded about 17,000 Soviet soldiers to date, by the CIA's classified estimate. They controlled 62% of the countryside, and had become so effective that the Soviets would have to triple or quadruple their deployments in Afghanistan to put the rebellion down. Soviet forces had so far lost about 350 to 400 aircraft in combat, the CIA estimated. The Mujahideen had also destroyed about 2,750 Soviet tanks and armored carriers, and just under 8,000 trucks, jeeps, and other vehicles. The war had already cost the Soviet government about $12 billion in direct expenses. All this mayhem had been purchased by U.S. taxpayers for $200 million so far, plus another $200 million contributed by Prince Turki's GID, Casey reported. Islamabad Station Chief Howard Hart's argument that covert action in Afghanistan was proving cost-effective had never been laid out so starkly for the White House. By early 1984, Casey was among the most ardent of the jihad's true believers. After arriving at CIA headquarters in a whirlwind of controversy and ambition in 1981, it had taken Casey a year or two to focus on the details of the Afghan program. Now he was becoming its champion. Hopping oceans in his unmarked C-141 Starlifter to meet with Turki, Akhtar, and Zia, Casey cut deals that more than doubled CIA and Saudi GID spending on the Afghan Mujahideen by year's end, and he began to endorse, or at least tolerate, provocative operations that skirted the edges of American law. Outfitted with mortars, boats, and target maps, Afghan rebels carrying CIA-printed Holy Qurans in the Uzbek language secretly crossed the Amu Darya River to mount sabotage and propaganda operations inside Soviet Central Asia. The incursions marked the first outside-sponsored violent guerrilla activity on Soviet soil since the early 1950s. They were the kind of operations Casey loved most. He faced resistance within the CIA. His initial deputy, Bobby Ray Inman, saw covert action as a naive, quick fix. After Inman left, Casey's second deputy director, John McMahon, a blunt Irish veteran of the agency's spy satellite division, worried continually that something in the Afghan covert program was going to go badly wrong and that the agency was going to be hammered on Capitol Hill. He wondered about the purpose of the U.S. covert war in Afghanistan, whether it could be sustained, and whether the Reagan administration was putting enough emphasis on diplomacy to force the Soviets to leave. McMahon wanted to manage the Afghan arms pipeline defensively, sending only basic weapons, preserving secrecy to the greatest possible extent. There was a concern between what I call the sensible bureaucrats, having been one of them, and the rabid right, recalled Thomas Twetton, one of McMahon's senior colleagues in the clandestine service. Also, the CIA's analysts in the Soviet division of the Director of Intelligence told Casey that no amount of aid to the Mujahideen was likely to force a Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. In one classified assessment, they predicted that the Soviet military would pressure the Afghan rebels until the cost of continued resistance was too high for the insurgents to bear. These career analysts regarded Soviet economic and military power as vast and unshakable. Casey, too, saw the Soviet Union as a mighty giant, but he wanted to confront the communists where they were weakest, and Afghanistan was such a place. Reagan's election had brought to power in Washington a network of conservatives, Casey among them, who were determined to challenge Soviet power worldwide. Their active, risk-taking vision embraced the full range of competition between the superpowers. They endorsed a Star Wars missile defense to nullify the threat of Soviet nuclear missiles. They backed the deployment of new medium-range Pershing missiles to Europe to raise the stakes of a Soviet invasion there. Led by Reagan himself, they spoke of the Soviet Union not in the moderating language of détente, but in a religious vocabulary of good and evil. They were prepared to launch covert action wherever it might rattle Soviet power, to support the Solidarity labor movement in Poland, and to arm anti-communist rebels in Central America and Africa. The Afghan theater seemed especially compelling to Casey and his conservative allies because of the stark aggression of the Soviet invasion, the direct use of Soviet soldiers, and their indiscriminate violence against Afghan civilians. By 1984, some in Congress wanted the CIA to do more for the Afghan rebels. Compared to the partisan controversies raging over Nicaragua, the Afghan covert action program enjoyed a peaceful consensus on Capitol Hill. The program's maniacal champion was Representative Charlie Wilson, a tall, boisterous Texas Democrat in polished cowboy boots who was in the midst of what he later called the longest midlife crisis in history. An alcoholic, Wilson abused government privileges to travel the world first class with former beauty queens who had earned such titles as Miss Sian Ski and Miss Humble Oil. Almost accidentally, he preferred to think of it as destiny, Wilson had become enthralled by the Mujahideen. Through a strange group of fervently anti-communist Texas socialites, Wilson traveled often to meet Zia and to visit the Khyber Pass overlooking Afghanistan. He had few Afghan contacts and knew very little about Afghan history or culture. He saw the Mujahideen through the prism of his own whiskey-soaked romanticism, as noble savages fighting for freedom, as almost biblical figures. Wilson used his trips to the Afghan frontier in part to impress upon a succession of girlfriends how powerful he was. The former Miss Northern Hemisphere, also known as Snowflake, recalled a trip to Peshawar. It was just very, very exciting to be in that room with those men with their huge white teeth, and it was very clandestine. Beginning in 1984, Wilson began to force more money and more sophisticated weapon systems into the CIA's classified Afghan budget, even when Langley wasn't interested. Goaded by small but passionate anti-communist lobbies in Washington, Wilson argued that the CIA's lukewarm attitude toward the jihad, exemplified by McMahon, amounted to a policy of fighting the Soviets to the last Afghan. The agency was sending just enough weaponry to ensure that many brave Afghan rebels died violently in battle, but not enough to help them win. As a resolution pushed through Congress by Wilson put it, "It would be indefensible to provide the freedom fighters with only enough aid to fight and die, but not enough to advance their cause of freedom." He told congressional committee members on the eve of one crucial funding vote, "The U.S. had nothing whatsoever to do with these people's decision to fight. They made this decision on Christmas Eve, and they're going to fight to the last, even if they have to fight with stones. But we'll be damned by history if we let them fight with stones." Those arguments resonated with William Casey, the jowly grandson of an Irish saloonkeeper. Casey was a 71-year-old self-made multimillionaire whose passionate creeds of Catholic faith and anti-communist fervor distinguished him from many of the career officers who populated Langley. The professionals in the clandestine service were inspired by Casey's enthusiasm for high-rolling covert action, but, like McMahon, some of them worried that he would gamble the CIA's credibility and lose. Still, they loved his energy and clout. By the mid-1980s, Casey had established himself as perhaps the most influential man in the Reagan administration after the president. He was able to shape foreign policy and win backing even for high-risk schemes. Reagan had broken precedent and appointed Casey as a full member of his cabinet. It was already becoming clear that Casey would be the most important CIA director in a generation. An eclectic crusader in his life's twilight, he bullied opponents and habitually evaded rule books. He was fixated on the Soviet Union. He believed that the epochal conflict between the United States and the Soviets would not be settled by a nuclear arms race or by war in Europe. Casey's reading of Soviet doctrine and history convinced him that Andropov's aging KGB-dominated Politburo intended to avoid an apocalyptic nuclear exchange with the West. Instead, they would pursue the Brezhnev doctrine by waging a slow campaign, across generations if necessary, to surround and undermine America's capitalist democracy by sponsoring Marxists in wars of national liberation waged in the Third World. Casey saw himself as about the only person in Reagan's cabinet who fully understood this tenacious Soviet strategy. He was prepared to confront the communists on their chosen ground. He was a Catholic knight of Malta, educated by Jesuits. Statues of the Virgin Mary filled his mansion, Mary Knoll, on Long Island. He attended Mass daily, and urged Christian faith upon anyone who asked his advice. Once settled at the CIA, he began to funnel covert action funds through the Catholic Church to anti-communists in Poland and Central America, sometimes